first of all giving some background context to Amílcar Cabral, and then I'll talk through some of the themes in his thought which speak to the international, speak to the question of the international. I hope I'll be talking for around about the right amount of time. It's strange because it isn't delivering, you know, it's not the same as giving a seminar paper, so I'm not entirely sure how long it'll take me to talk through my notes. So, first of all, just starting off with some background about Cabral. He may or may not be familiar to some of you. Amílcar Cabral was born in 1924 in Guinea, which at that time was a colony of Portugal, a small colonial territory in West Africa. And when he was young, his family moved to the archipelago of Cape Verde, and he went to school there. He did very well in school. He was awarded a scholarship. And so in 1945, at the age of 20, he travelled to Portugal, to Lisbon, to study agronomy in the Institute of Agronomy in Lisbon University. This is a fairly typical pattern of anti-colonial thinkers, because essentially there were no institutions of higher education in the colonies. In the Portuguese colonies, it was a similar pattern to the British Empire, the French Empire, and so on. So in the trajectory of figures who would go on to become anti-colonial leaders, moving from their colonial territory to study, to continue their studies in higher education in the colonial metropole, is echoed people like Leopold Senghor, Aimé Césaire, Léon Damas, Frantz Fanon, Nkrumah, Nyerere, Kenyatta, and so on. It's a typical pattern. In the Portuguese empire, colonial empire, so Cabral would have been one of a tiny minority to have received education to the level to be able to go on to higher education in Portugal. Overall, he would have been in the category of what the Portuguese called assimilados, which means the sort of elite, African elite who are considered to be civilized or assimilated into Portuguese culture, which basically constituted more or less than 1% of the population in the colonies. So he studied in Lisbon and he did his degree in agronomy. And after graduating, he started doing agrarian research as an employee of the colonial state, and he did that in traveling around the empire. In Guinea, he did a survey of soil conditions in the whole of Guinea, and he also did some soil research in Angola. And at the same time, by this time, he was politically active, so under the cover of his position of employment, he started to organising. He was central in founding the PAIGC, which was the nationalist movement of Guinea and Cape Verde, in 1956, and he was also involved with Agostinho Neto in founding MPLA, one of the main Angolan liberation movements in the same year. So he then went on to lead the independence liberation war of Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde until his death in 1973. He didn't live to see Guinea's independence nor the fall of the Portuguese regime in 1974. So he's widely seen as a crucial figure in Guinea-Bissau's liberation war. He's seen as a very shrewd military and political strategist and a very significant international diplomat. He was very charismatic. He had a real strong sense of the image and the need for diplomacy, but also of visual presentation. I'm here going to talk about some dimensions of his political thought, especially with regard to the international. And this, just a bit of background about me. My current research is looking at the political thought and practice of the liberation movements of all of the Portuguese colonies in Africa. And so, to the extent that I'm currently doing research about Cabral, it's not focusing on him as such as an individual, but rather in the context of the collaboration with. So I'm trying to look at the thought of the liberation movements. And obviously that is partly articulated through individuals, one of the most prominent of which was Cabral. But an important element of their practice was precisely collaboration. So that's one of the themes in my work, which I'm trying to currently bring out. So that's just a bit of background. So I'm now going to talk through some themes in terms of Amilcar Cabral as a thinker of the international, as a global thinker, or as a marginalised voice in international relations. And in doing that, the first point to make really is to say that Amilcar Cabral was not a scholar of international relations. So we can't look to his work to find any obvious or explicit theorising about IR. For those of you, I mean, I understand that this is quite a mixed audience, which is fantastic, but for those of you who are studying international relations, you'll know what I mean when I say that. If you're not studying international relations, that might sound quite obscure, and so much the better, in my view. But anyway, so you won't, you know, it would be pointless to sort of do a compare and contrast Cabral's thought of the international with other, you know, recognised IR scholars. And in fact, I would say to the extent that he was a scholar as such, his academic training obviously was in agronomy, and he did publish research papers in the field of agronomy. His political thought is... So, and partly when I'm saying that, I'm also saying that he didn't... His political thought is not expressed in academic writing as such. It's rather expressed or... manifest in a huge body of essentially political documents of speeches and reports and manifestos and interviews and so on, all of which he gave or wrote in the context of anti-colonial struggle, which itself is perhaps I'll come back to say a little bit at the end that, you know, we need to think of the category of anti-colonial thought as a historically specific category of thought in itself. But in this body of texts, of course, he did engage with the international. He had necessarily to engage with the character of the international, because the struggle he was leading, the struggle for independence for a very small and very poor country or countries, Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde, was necessary because of the colonial and imperial character of the international order. And that struggle had necessarily to be waged at the international level in terms of fighting for recognition and legitimacy, as well as on the ground in Guinea. So I'm going to organise my comments, my sort of exploration through some dimensions of his thought around three themes: race. So I was looking there because I thought the title would be there, but it doesn't matter. Race, colonialism, and liberation. So, first of all, the question of race. What did Cabral have to say about race? And how come he ended up thinking about race, and in particular the international dimensions of race? And this, I'm going to start off by going right back to his time in Lisbon, from the late 1940s, the early 1950s, which was also the early period of his coming to be an anti-colonial militant and leader. So in those years, the late 1940s, the early 1950s, he was studying in Lisbon, and he had a group of friends, colleagues, other African students from Angola, Mozambique, and São Tomé. Cabral was studying agronomy, others were studying classics, sociology, training to teach, studying medicine. At this time, and so basically this group of African students studying together formed a fairly intense research community among themselves. At the time, the main institutional focus for students from the colonies in Lisbon and Coimbra was an institution called the Casa dos Estudantes do Império, the house of the students of the empire. And originally these sort of houses, these small institutions, had been set up by the students themselves, but in 1944, the Estado Novo, the state, sort of took over and consolidated and established this institution with the ambition of consolidating the ideology and legitimacy of the empire. So in the early years, this institution, the Casa, was fairly dominated by white students of colonial settler families from the colonies. So the group of African students found it too restrictive to set up as a place for open debate. So they set up their own clandestine group called the Centro de Estudos Africanos, the Centre for African Studies, and Cabral was one of the key instigators of setting up this group as essentially a sort of informal research group. They used to meet on Sundays in the house of a São Tomean family in Lisbon, and they drew up a research agenda. Questions of culture were at the heart of their research, but their themes are very wide-ranging. So they drew up a research agenda with a set of themes and headings, and they allocated the topics amongst themselves, and each person would take it in turns to go and research the topic and present. So the topics were land and man, African socio-economic, obviously they're in Portuguese, but I've translated them, Negro thought, the problems of the Portuguese Empire and the rest of Black Africa, the Negro in the world, the central problems for the advance of the Black world. And so we can see already that they were framing their inquiries with reference to both Africa and race, or the Negro world. And that's partly a response to their own experience of an overwhelming lack in the education that they had had up until that point of any information at all about their own societies and histories and cultures and geographies. The education they had received through the Portuguese educational system was entirely in the Portuguese language and about Portuguese culture and history. So it was this sort of very deeply, keenly felt inquiry that they were doing together was partly in response to that. And it was also, of course, responding to the sort of prevailing language and thought of those times, especially the idea of the Negro world. And this context was a context of very intense activity and shared debate by Cabral and his colleagues, Agostinho Neto, who went on to be the leader of MPLA, the Angolan Liberation Movement, Marcelino dos Santos from Mozambique, who went on to be a key figure in Frelimo. Eduardo Mondlane passed through briefly on his way from Mozambique to America. Noemi de Souza, who was a Mozambican poet, Alda de Espírito Santo, who was a leading figure in the São Tomé liberation movement, and so on. So they read as much as they could get hold of. It was a context of very strong censorship in Lisbon at the time. The Estado Novo was essentially a fascist regime, so there was a very strong censorship. But nevertheless, through various clandestine means, they managed to get hold of various texts, and they read as widely as they could. They read and were influenced especially by, for example, African-American writers of the Harlem Renaissance, such as Langston Hughes, County Colin, René Marin, Richard Wright, George Amado, Nicolas Guillain, and so on. And they also read Aimé Césaire and Léopold Senghor and others of Negritude. And they read, they translated, they wrote themselves, they wrote poetry. So it was an intense sort of process of finding out about the world and about themselves. So in this context, in the early 50s, essentially they were very, very struck by, and they started off embracing Negritude. I don't know to what extent people here are familiar with Negritude. I'm sure you all are. But essentially, it was a strand of literature and philosophy whose leading figures were Léopold Senghor of Senegal, Aimé Césaire of Martinique, and Léon Damas of Guyana. But the strand of Negritude which was most... Well, I mean, for them, I think they were as equally influenced by Césaire's writing as Senghor. But the strand of Negritude, which was most sharply contested within Africa, was Senghor's ideas, because he essentially promoted an idea of a core, essential Black African culture, which was shared by all Black people in the world. And so when they first encountered the writings and the poetry of Senghor and Césaire and others, which was a movement to claim and valorise and be proud of black African culture and the worth of being black, hence the term negritude, it was tremendously important to them because they had all, having gone through a process of essentially enforced assimilation into the Portuguese culture, which was obviously a racialized process. So their initial response was an embrace of negritude. Mario Andrade, who was another whose name I forgot to mention, he was an Angolan, says, later recalled, for example, that there's a letter from Amilcar to his fiancée at the time, Maria Helena, where he talks of his fascination with the poetry of negritude. So they organised talks, they translated works, they translate, for example, Noemi de Souza translated Aimé Césaire's Discourse on Colonialism, and so on. They wrote poetry as well as their research papers. They organised the publication of a collection of poetry in 1953 called Notebook of Black Poetry in Portuguese, which was directly following on from and obviously inspired by and explicitly positioned as a successor to and within the same movement as Senghor's seminal anthology of 1948, just a few years earlier, the anthology of New Black and Malgache poetry in French. So they understood their own expression at this time to be a contribution to the movement of negritude. Cabral was a key figure in this group. He himself, he did write some poetry in the early years, but he didn't specifically contribute poems for this collection. But the point I'm saying here is that at this time, negritude really spoke to them as essentially as alienated African elites in the heart of the Portuguese fascist empire, as black people shouting out their presence to the world. By the late 1950s, Cabral and his fellow militants had arrived at a far more radical position, in terms of the question of race and in terms of the politics of anti-colonial struggle. And this led them to explicitly reject a racial framing of their culture and identity and of their struggles. And I think the key here is their growing and acute awareness and analysis of the contradictions of the relationship between them as assimilados and the majority, the vast majority of the African population in the colonies, the so-called indigena. Or native, you would say in English. So basically, they ended up concluding that this search for endorsing a black African cultural identity was essentially the project of the alienated assimilado elite, not the masses. And so this explicit rejection of a racial framing is then found repeatedly. They didn't sort of write lengthy papers rejecting or critiquing negritude as many other African scholars did, but rather sort of in occasional asides, but nevertheless pointed comments. This rejection of a racial framing is found repeatedly across Cabral's writings from the late 50s or early 60s onwards. He later characterised the idea of negritude and also Pan-Africanism, actually, as what he called the re-Africanization of the spirits, which he acknowledged as a necessary process to go through, especially for the elite, the assimilado, those who had been educated and formed as Portuguese. But as their own national liberation struggles began, they, from the very start, were very much aware of their own alienation from their compatriots, the vast majority of Africans who had no formal education at all. And, you know, they sort of realised the fact that if they wrote this beautiful poetry, the majority of their own compatriots wouldn't even be able to read it. So I think it was that contradiction and their awareness of it and the centrality of overcoming that contradiction to the national liberation struggle, which was at the heart of Cabral and his colleagues' eventual strong rejection of a racial framing of their struggles, and they repeatedly emphasised that their struggles were being waged against, not against white people and not against the Portuguese people, but against the Portuguese colonial system. Mm. And actually, I think that position, having arrived at that position at that time, was very important, because I think, I need to look into this more, but I think that at this time across Africa, a racial framing of Pan-Africanism was actually essentially the sort of strongest currency. And for example, Nelson Mandela, when he went on his tour of Africa in 1962, found that the ANC's position, which was a multiracial position at the time, was not necessarily met with a lot of favour at the time. So I think that's, you know, them reaching that position in the context of the broader continental politics of Africa at the time is very significant. Okay, so hang on a sec. So, for example, let me just read out a few quotations. He said things like, "The time is past when it was necessary to..." This is Cabral. "The time has passed when it was necessary to seek arguments to prove the cultural maturity of African peoples," which kind of, to me, expresses a kind of, you know, by the early 60s, a sort of impatience with negritude and so on. He said, "We do not confuse exploitation with people's skin colour." And he confirmed that an objective analysis of cultural reality denies the existence of racial or continental cultures. "Culture is a social reality independent of man's will, or of the colour of his skin or the shape of his eyes." So that's just a quick whistle-top tour through his engagement with the question of race. I'm now going to just say a few things about his analysis of the idea of colonialism and imperialism in international relations. And I'm going to make two points under this theme. The first is that in Cabral's writings, in Cabral's various writings, we find a strong sense of the contemporary international order. We find a strong sense of the contemporary international order and of the preceding centuries of international relations as having been structured fundamentally by colonialism and imperialism, which was a profoundly unjust order of international relations. So, for example, in the manifesto of MAC, the anti-colonial movement, the Movimiento Anticolonialista, which was founded in Cabral was one of the five to draw it up in 1957 alongside... So one of the things about the liberation movements is that they established a succession of collaborative organisations through to link the struggles of Angola, Mozambique, Guinea and Cape Verde and São Tomé. And Cabral was a central figure in all of those. So the MAC manifesto, which was the anti-colonial movement manifesto, which was drawn up in 1957... They set out a summary of the various stages of how colonialism historically had been legitimised. The idea of historical right, the idea of effective occupation at the Berlin Conference, the discourse of protecting and securing the development of colonised peoples in the context of the League of Nations. And then they said all of these have been negated by the United Nations Charter. And so therefore, at that point, all of those legal rationales for colonialism were over. But they then said, in any case, our peoples never gave their prior consent to any of those principles. So saying, even if the United Nations, even if the international order from 1945 has finally, or rather from 1960 actually, has finally caught up, that all of those principles were never just. So he has a very keen sense of this longer history of colonialism. He often refers to the five centuries of Portuguese colonialism that they've suffered. And equally, he elaborated a strong analysis of the continuing imperial character of international relations despite the launching or the era of the United Nations manifest, especially in their experience, of course, in the international relations of the colonial wars in the Portuguese colonies. In other words, the fact that Portugal, as a very poor semi-agricultural country itself, could never be able to sustain distant wars in three countries without very substantial financial and diplomatic and military aid from several Western powers. So he referred to Portugal as a poor, underdeveloped, agricultural, semi-literate European country. Portugal was essentially too poor to be neo-colonial. It was a semi-colony of Britain, and so was therefore reliant on the support of Western allies to fight its colonial wars. So he strongly emphasised the international relations of the colonial wars, which in itself was a manifestation of contemporary imperialism. The second point that I want to emphasise here is what I think is, what I find is a really significant and powerful element of Cabral's way of characterising colonialism and imperialism as a violent interruption in a country's or a society's or people's historical process. Mm. So he sets this point out in various texts, including in one of his most famous, which I could have circulated but didn't precisely because it is his most famous, called The Weapon of Theory, which was a speech that he gave at the Tricontinental Conference in Havana in 1966. He says, the principal characteristic common to every kind of imperialist domination is the denial of the historical process of the dominated people by means of violent usurpation of the freedom of the process of development of the productive forces. Or elsewhere, the principal characteristic of imperialist domination is the usurpation by violence of the freedom of the process of development of the dominated socioeconomic whole. And finally, colonialism, the paralysis or detour or even the total halting of the history of a people in favour of accelerating the historical development of other peoples. I think that final quote is actually the strongest. And as a consequence, therefore, he says it's the inalienable right of people, not simply for self-determination, but it's the inalienable right of people to their own history, which therefore requires taking back control over their own, the conditions of possibility for their own history. And this leads on to the third point I want to make here, which is about his theory and method. One of the questions which is often asked by any of any non-Western or African or anti-colonial thinker is, are they Marxist? Are they constructivist? Are they this? Are they that? Sort of trying to fit them into these pre-existing categories of thought. And I emphasised earlier that Cabral and his fellow militants read very widely in their early days in Lisbon and thereafter. They read whatever they could get hold of. And they read whatever was relevant to them. And of course this included reading Marxist literature along with all sorts of other literature. But, and on the other hand, as I've already said, Cabral's texts weren't academic texts, so he doesn't provide references in bibliography for the most part. They were political texts. So for example, in The Weapon of Theory, his speech in Havana, there is a clear use of Marxist terminology. But we also find what today we would recognise as an explicit, pointed rejection of the Eurocentric vision of much Marxist thought. So he takes issue with the notion that the class struggle is the motor of history, saying that this implies that societies which have not yet reached the point of clear class struggle therefore exist outside of history or haven't entered history yet or have no history. And he also points out the need to take into account that the very process of class struggle needs to be rethought to include the effects of external colonial domination on social processes within a society. He says history doesn't only begin from the moment of launching the phenomenon of class struggle. To accept this would be to place outside history the whole period of life of human groups from the discovery of hunting and later of nomadic and sedentary and so on. And this we refuse to accept. And he says, so instead he takes the category of mode of production rather than class struggle as the central dynamic in history. And he says, doing so avoids preempting, I'm sure, Eric Wolf, he says, the sad position of being peoples without history. So just to finish off, have I got a few more minutes?
You do.
Yes, you do.
You do.
Okay, fine. just to finish off with the theme of liberation, and I'll elaborate 2 points here in regard to the question of national liberation. The first is, and one of the most famous and significant points that Cabral made about the struggle for national liberation, is that it was an act of culture. Mm. And this point, this claim, this argument, directly echoes that of Frantz Fanon. He made very much the same point and argument in his speech to the Second Congress of Black Artists and Writers in 1959, the second Congress organised by the Présence Africaine, following on from the first one in Paris in 1956. Cabral met Fanon and certainly would have had discussions with him, though to what extent he read Fanon's writings, I don't know. And as I've already said, you know, he doesn't provide a sort of detailed references and footnotes and bibliography and so on. But the point is, to what extent he was directly influenced by Fanon in this formulation, and they were. I mean, the some of the leading members of MAC were at the conference in Rome. But nevertheless, Cabral and his colleagues elaborated this idea in their own way. And that elaboration emerged from the context and the practical imperatives of the struggles that they were fighting, and of having to think through the actual process of mobilising disparate peoples of various ethnic groups and various experiences and so on to form a unified liberation movement with a clear understanding of who they were fighting and why. So, in a sense, unpacking the sort of 3 strands to this idea of the national liberation struggle being an act of culture. The first is their argument that, and this kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier on about their eventual moving beyond the idea of negritude and that idea of culture. The first point that Cabral makes very strongly is that the very possibility of the national liberation struggle springs from the cultural resources of the majority of the masses, of the African masses under colonialism. That despite colonialism's efforts to destroy the culture of the colonised, it doesn't succeed, and it's because of the enduring cultural resources of the colonised that makes possible resistance and then the national liberation movement. Secondly, the struggle itself is a context for forging a new culture. And the struggle in itself is a context for the forging of a new culture, specifically in a way that transcends or kind of resets relations of class and ethnicity. On the one hand, I've already talked about this, the way in which the liberation movements, Cabral in particular, and all of his colleagues in the liberation movements grappled with the reality and contradictions of the difference between the elite assimilados and the majority of indigena, but at the same time they also had to grapple with the reality of colonial territories, even in the case of Guinea, which is small compared to Angola and Mozambique, the need to organise a unified liberation struggle which incorporated different, what we'd call ethnic groups or peoples with different languages and experiences and modes of social organisation and so on. And so he saw the liberation struggle as a way to enable both those sets of social relations to be sort of reconfigured in the context of the struggle. The need for all peoples of a territory to work together, thereby gaining a new sense of national identity in addition to their local, regional, ethnic identity. And on the other hand, the need for the assimilados to work with the indigena and thereby sort of break free from their own alienation. So referring back to what I said before about Cabral's critique of, he comes to characterise ideas of like Pan-Africanism and negritude as re-Africanisation of the spirits, which was necessary for the elite. But he comes later to say, actually, for the elite really to undergo this process of re-Africanization of the spirits is by joining with the masses in the struggle for national liberation. And finally, the struggle for national liberation creates the space, especially in the liberated zones, for building society in new ways, and especially for new education and broader social organisation in the liberated zones. And just to finish, the second point that I want to make in terms of their idea, the Cabral's, what he says about liberation, national liberation, is the way in which he repeatedly situates it in the international global times, or their international and world historical moment, and the significance of their contribution. He emphasises that their contribution was not just to their own national liberation, but that they were making a sort of world historical contribution at that time. He consciously and explicitly saw their struggles as making a contribution to the whole world, to the historical moment and dynamics of the mid-20th century. And I've already said how he very explicitly rejected a racial framing of their struggles and insisted that they were struggling against Portuguese colonialism, not the Portuguese people. We could say, in a sense, he was a sort of anti-colonial humanist in a similar way, perhaps, to that Fanon similarly endorsed a different kind of humanism. Cabral expressed his international understanding of their struggles in part in terms of colonialism and imperialism, that they were not simply fighting against Portuguese colonialism, but against imperialism, but also in terms of international morality and legality. So he emphasised that in fighting against colonial rule, they were fighting to re-establish their freedom and dignity, and that the legitimacy of their struggles didn't derive in itself from the formal declarations of international law, but rather, as I've already said, that in a sense international law had caught up in finally acknowledging the injustice and crimes of colonialism and the justice and legality of their and all other anti-colonial struggles. And most poignantly, perhaps, in the context of the mid-20th century, with all of these Western powers supporting Portugal in the 1960s, well into the early 1970s, they understood they understood themselves to be fighting to defend the United Nations, to defend international legality and international morality. He says at one point that he calls themselves anonymous soldiers of the United Nations. Yeah. So that's it.